Welcome to the Dad's Group podcast. My name is Bernsey.
And I am the fabulous Blair. Dad's Group is about helping fathers, helping families. And what we aim to do on this podcast is bring you conversations that will build up your fathering and support the growth of your family. Well, what we like to do at the beginning of every episode, every time we meet actually, we just like to check in with each other. Bernsey, how are you out of 10, mate?
Yeah, well, I was an 8 earlier, but just in the little bit that we've been chatting, even just trying to get our microphones working, I'm up to a 10, man. How are you?
It's always an adventure, man. Technology, dude. I'm an eight. We've had a full-on week, so probably beginning of the week I was lowered down to a 3. We've had family sicknesses. So Patty, my nearly 3-month-old, had bronchitis. That was full-on, man. It's just the difficult part of parenting is like, what do I do? And you got to try and figure it out. Is he that sick? Is he too sick? You know. Mm. So anyway, ambulance had to pick him up, take him to the hospital, and he was on oxygen for a couple of days, but he's home now. He's got a bit of a full-on cough, but other than that, he's doing a lot better. So, yeah, up at a 10, no, not up at a 10, up at an 8 today.
Yeah, sick. Hey, so last episode I chatted with Dave Joyner, a good friend of mine, and I love that chat.
It's great.
He brought in a whole lot of different ideas and techniques from what he does in his work with young people. But one of the things he talked about is something that he's been working with young people and families on. And it's called Your Code. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't listened to the episode yet, really encourage you to go back. But basically, the code, the idea is that you take 3 values or 3 words that really represent what you believe and value most about how you want to see and treat yourself, see and treat others, and sort of what's the driving motivation underneath that. So basically, yeah, you establish what those 3 words are, and you can use those then to, in every situation you find yourself, to ask yourself, am I living in accordance with the way I want to be in this world? Mm. Today, I just wanted to, maybe for you and I, Blair, to pick a value or a word that would be part of our code, just as an example, and just to sort of flesh out again what Dave talked to us about in that last episode. So let's, you want to go first? What would be the word you'd choose?
Absolutely. It was good to really reflect on this because you'd have heard me say the word intentional or intentionality in other episodes. And when you listen through again, like when I listened through that episode again, when we chatted briefly before, I'm like, oh, how am I going with that, with intentionality? So what I mean by that is we're just very intentional with teaching our kids. So when they've done something wrong, it's not just like, you've done something wrong, time out. It's like explaining why, even when it's drastic, like they do drastic things all the time. Intentionality with our relationship with them, their relationship with each other, their relationship with other people, whatever else it might be. But intentionality, I think, would be a key word that we would use as something that we strive for in many different areas because it's such a broad word. But
cool.
How about you, mate?
Yeah, I was gonna say authenticity, but as I was listening to you and I was just thinking about it, I think I might switch to genuine. Which is I guess similar, but I think for me it has a bit more rawness and vulnerability. Just in the way I understand it and think about being genuine to myself and being genuinely myself, but then also being genuine in relationships. I think it has a different take than being authentic with people. I think being genuine is really honoring the relationship, honoring the other person, as well as being real to yourself. So I think that's something I want to live more by, because I know throughout my life, the genuine moments are the ones where I've had some really positive experiences in my life. So I think genuine is something I want to draw out more as I go forward. But really good exercise. And it's as simple as just Googling, lists of values and just going through and see which ones resonate with you and seeing which ones apply to how you want to be. And as Dave was saying, you can even use it as a family, and using that and how you talk with your kids and how you prepare them for different things. So, yeah.
No, it was great, man. And like I said, it's a good thing to reflect on. So finding a word or words that really resonate with you on values that you have for yourself and your family, and then you like you get a measuring stick. You know what I mean? Like you get to check in a month's time, check in with your partner, or if you don't have a partner, check in with another dad's, you know, another dad that you know, and just say like, how are you going with that? Like, what are things that you can improve? But if we don't have that intentionality, using that word again, if we don't have that or those specific words, we're kind of shooting in the dark. Like, what are we aiming for? Become a better dad. What does that look like, man? That's such a broad term. So, yeah, the words really helped me.
Yeah, definitely.
But anyway, mates, who have we got this week?
Yeah, so I chatted with Ross Muir. He's actually my cousin-in-law. He is... at the moment, he's acting principal at one of the big state high schools here in Brisbane. He's been an educator for a long time now. And he's a father to two boys. And he's someone that ever since I married into the family, like I've sort of bounced back and forth with about, you know, family and career and how's that all blend together. But what I talked to him about in this interview you're about to hear is how do you pick the right school for your kids and when is the right time? What do you look for? How do you understand all the different statistics and data and scores and all different things that come out? You know, you sort of see in newspapers all the time or even there's websites dedicated now to ranking different schools, but he really breaks it open from within the school perspective of how you can really understand what the environment of a school is and how that's going to fit with your own child. So really, really, really practical episode again today that I think will really help some of our families maybe reduce some of that stress and anxiety about getting your kid into the right school. And yeah, I think it's going to shed a lot of light on how schools sort of work and what the relationship between school and family can look like. So enjoy this episode with Ross Muir. Well, welcome to the Dad's Group podcast, Ross.
Thanks, mate.
We start every interview by asking how you're going out 10. So how are you going out 10?
Yeah, I think I'm today I would sport a pretty solid 8 out of 10.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in my first week of holidays.
Nice.
Just did a successful drop-off with the boys.
That's always helpful.
Feeling pretty good about a day to speak with you.
Yeah. Well, we might... for our listeners, if you wouldn't mind just sort of giving a bit of introduction, I should give a bit of a disclaimer. We are family, so
yes.
Pulling family onto the podcast.
Declaration. Call it now.
That's it. Conflict of interest, all the rest. Yeah. But for our listeners, if you could sort of just introduce a bit of yourself, your story, your work, your family.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm Ross Muir. I'm 38 years of age. I have been married for 9 years to my wife, Kate. We have two children, a 5-year-old Hugo and an 18-month-year-old named George.
Yep.
I've been an educator for 17 years professionally. I live in Ashgrove currently and have basically lived in what we colloquially call the Gap Grove area, which is the Gap in Ashgrove. All of my schooling and all of my memories are in this particular area of the world. It's no surprise that I've kind of taken myself back here to where it all began. And it's, you know, lots of nostalgia sits around the area. Yeah. So, you know.
It must be pretty cool bringing up your family. It's sort of in that same context of what your memories are.
Definitely. And I think because they were so dear to me and I've talked, you know, quite a lot about my experiences at school and how they've impacted me today. If I can kind of provide similar trajectory or experiences of my own kids, you know, they'd be pretty well put together and pretty well sorted, you know, from my point of view, mate. And, but look, I've, as I said, I've been a teacher for 17 years. I've taught, you know, at lots of places, different metropolitan contexts, a little bit of bush service in there. Definitely, you know, has been around at my 17 years as a professional. So, and both my partner and I are educators, so I think that's really critical.
Yeah.
You know, working in education instills, I think, the compassion and care that, you know, translates to how you are as a dad or how you are as a mum, the kind of patience and the kind of work that you do navigating that space. We're very lucky to have had some years under the belt.
And talking about that parenting journey, what's been a highlight for you so far?
So there's a few, this is a really good question because I feel like for me, the biggest roller coaster journey, and I think many men go through this, but the scientific fertility work with IVF and, you know, the big jolt to your life working that through. And with our first child, you know, many trials and tribulations, many lack of successes and the emotions that sit around that. And I think with our first child, when we actually naturally were able to do, you know, that great work, it was huge triumph for Kate and I, very emotionally overwhelming. And I think that, you know, that's probably one of the biggest things. I don't think about the pit of money that we buried around the IVF and the sites. You need to forego that because once it happens, it happens.
Yeah.
And it was really, really one of those things where, you know, you're humbled, you pick yourself up, you feel vulnerable, you rally again, then you get whacked back again a few notches.
Yeah.
So having our first and that moment was probably, you know, the highlight of our journey so far. And of course, we've had, you know, two kids now and, you know, I know that many men and women go through some of those challenges around fertility. And it's only in recently that I've spoken to some lads and, you know, when you're around a barbecue and you've got a beer in your hand and you're sort of calm, you see some of that come out. But, you know, people talking about it and you realise just how much more common it is than you perceive. And I think that blokes typically don't disclose or engage in that kind of chat.
Yeah.
But I think today I've just found that, you know, some people are well warming up to talking about it, and there's a larger percentage than you think that are impacted. Yeah. So tough world to navigate. Yeah. And I think for me, that was, you know, huge for Kate and I.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many different things, you know, I could talk about, but I think talking to other men and talking to people who are in the earliest stages of being a parent, the work that you do in complementing your partner during that time is kind of critical.
Yeah.
And being cued into your partner and the kind of physiological, emotional, physical impact and toll of that world taught me a lot about being empathic and really watching my partner at different times to make sure that I was doing the work to combat the difficulties after you have a child, and, you know, the kind of spiral that can happen in your world and the non-linear way that parenthood actually is, you know, the kind of up and down and even talking.
Yeah.
Which I think there is some reluctancy amongst blokes to talk through those things, but particularly around the IVF, I found, you know, calling it out for what it is around how it makes me feel that, you know, I know it's impacting you more acutely. This is how I feel around it. Working that through and being honest and transparent.
I think what you're hitting at too is, you know, like for blokes, I think the conversations around kids are falling pregnant and however that happens, whether naturally IVF or, you know, all the different parts of that. Having a baby, and again, like all the different conversations around natural birth interventions, all of that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sort of fast forward to, I think as blokes, like I defaulted to focusing on like maybe discipline or, you know, teaching my kids life lessons, mm-hmm. but you sort of miss all of those, I guess you know, soft skills or, you know, what you were just talking about being in tune with your partner. And, mm-hmm. And I think that's something that, yeah, as dads, we sort of, it's not portrayed as something that dads need to worry about. But there are a whole host of different conversations and different things that that play into that period after birth before you even get to any, you know, disciplining boundaries or life lessons with your kids. So,
And what paradigms are we working off?
Yeah.
Like I'm working off, you know, my dad's 74 today.
Yeah.
And I observed him as a kid, and a mum, and we use that as a way to kind of position, you know, on how they parented. And there's some, you kind of working things through. You might have a preconceived idea of what you're going to be like as a dad before you're a dad.
Yeah.
What actually hits the cold face though after that all happens is quite different. And,
for sure.
And I think, you know, I think that parents kind of do their best to try and orchestrate all the things that they want their kid to have, but there are things that are going to go by the wayside. So, you know, perfect example with Hugo is once we, you know, were able to determine, you know, after we had feeding issues and we had sleeping issues and then we had speech delays, going through all of those cycles of challenge, then, you know, late diagnosis of, not too late, but around that 2 mark of autism, you know, that was a game changer for us. There was no preparation we could have done 4 years before, 8 months before, any book we could have read, I think, that would have, you know, helped us work through it, except for, you know, again, being humbled by it, feeling really vulnerable, rallying, going, okay, what can we do? What are the, you know, what's the low-hanging fruit that we can work with? What do we need, who we need to speak with? And then making sure that, because we're both educators, we were going to put every single effort and a bit of energy into trying to make it as positive to him as possible. And, you know, we talk about, you know, milestones for me with him, with the challenges that he has developmentally, getting him to school without him being upset about that, initiating play sometimes and seeing that. These are huge triumphs that for others are probably kind of an expected thing around as a milestone. Riding a bike, you know, this holidays, that was the goal. You know, training wheels off, I'm like, nah, no more training wheels, we're doing this chair. You know, COVID threw him, he completely lost his confidence, and now training wheels are off. And the lad's riding, you know, 4 or 5K in the day.
Wow.
That's huge for him because he doesn't have the posture. He doesn't have the, those neurodivergent kids, the balance and the physical upper body strength. It's just not there like it is with other kids in terms of how they've kind of gone through life. And yeah, you know, that's just me being persistent and being a pest and, you know what I mean, we're pushing him and, you know, getting the tears and working it through and listening, but also being a little bit like my dad and just keep pushing and pushing, knowing where the boundary is. You know, I think we probably apply that to a range of different things. Again, would never have had a book to I could have referred to work out the last 4 years since his diagnosis. You know? But, you know, knowing what we know as educators and working with adolescents who are neurodivergent, you know, learners, we were well placed, I think, because we knew at the back end where there's early intervention, the work's done right and you're kind of building confidence in your kid and you're in a loving unit.
I feel like we've already hit so much gold in this chat. We haven't even. The reason we got you on the pod was to talk about from your experience as an educator. So I think we'll have to book in another time and talk through some of those other experiences. But we wanted to get you here as an educator and as someone who has worked at, I guess, a higher level within the system as well in leadership. If you could help us sort of break open that conversation with parents, with dads particularly, how do we actually approach this whole thing with education, picking schools and all the rest of it? So we want to really sort of break it open and get to some practicals and help parents sort of navigate the waters, so to speak.
But
I guess the first thing I wanted to hit, is there such a thing as talking about education, picking schools, is there a too early or a too late?
So I think there is definitely a too early. this is something that I'm aware of because I have mates who, before their kids were born, enrolled their kids at, you know, Terrace, Grandma, and then Mara's daughter, right? So, you know, three schools, child hasn't been born. And I feel like they're making a decision based on their experience and that there's a, in their head, there's a mental model that says that those schools will provide a superior education and quality. So I need to, you know, make that happen. I need to lock in. I've got to get them in. So once they're in and they get to interview and they get accepted, I've made this great choice. But I feel like there's a human element that's remiss here because if you commit to a particular sector, private, independent, Catholic, academy versus a rural or metro or state, like you've really got to be careful about making a decision before you've got a fulsome picture of what your child, what do they enjoy? What do they have a penchant for? What are their skill sets, you know? And I think it's not the fault of parents. They're kind of forced into this really strange market decision where they're enrolling a child before the child has been born or at a really early age. And you're making that decision based on what your own personal models are. Today, the decisions are a lot more informed by data, which I think is great. I think that data is very arbitrary. I think as a parent, you need to be really, really mindful of what league tables are that the local rag publishes, the top 50, you know, what are they using to determine that?
Yeah,
they're using a national test that are, you know, are from a car in our plan.
Yeah.
They're using PISA testing, which is done for social emotional, and they're looking at, you know, year 12 certification and making decisions around what's good, what's the benchmark for quality. And then they're making it public facing so that parents look at it. But what's happening, I think, is they're positioning you to think and feel a certain way.
Yeah.
And naturally, we compare.
Yeah.
We compare people on Facebook and Instagram. We compare people in all the time now, much more than ever.
Yeah.
And we contrast. And I think with schools, it's become so pervasive, the information, that parents are well-informed. But in terms of understanding the data and understanding the kind of other qualitative information around schools that's not public facing, there's still a bit of work that needs to be done.
Yeah.
So I think that's, it can be too early, and I don't want to put an age on it, because I think that an 8-year-old to an 11-year-old, I think, will show you what they're really interested in.
Yeah.
My son Hugo, who's almost 6, I have no idea at the moment of what he will be interested in. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I know what he likes to do, but I think that's going to evolve as he developmentally kind of catches up and starts honing in on things that he's particularly got a penchant or skill for. I would hate to think that I would say, Hugo's going to Marist, or, you know, making a blanket that decision, because I feel like he's not a part of the conversation.
Yeah.
And an 8 or 11-year-old may not know the implications of a decision, but they need to be a part of the conversation in some way.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think what I'm hearing there is, like, there is this almost social pressure, into, particularly if you're in a metropolitan, of, like, getting your kids onto a waiting list, even, you know, before they're born or just as they're born. There's this idea that certain schools can offer a better education. And, you know, I think what you're sort of saying here is there is this, I guess, opportunity to really get it to know our kids first.
Yeah.
And we can make a decision with them. They're really going to have that opportunity to thrive.
Yeah.
And not just fall into that same educational pressure that is on parents to get their kids into these good schools in the first place. You mentioned a couple of different types of schooling system there, Catholic, public, the academy.
Yeah.
Just on your experience and knowing that you've worked only in the state system, like, what could you say about the different types of schools? What might be some advantages, or what might be some of the things that parents could see in those different types of schools?
Yeah. So it's a good question. I think in my 17 years of experience, and I guess my own experience in the private system, you know, it's not just about state versus non-government.
Yeah.
It actually is around, at the moment, the market says that there are some independent grammar schools, there are some Catholic schools that are doing some amazing things, and some that aren't really hitting the mark.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there are stories that sit around that aren't present in the league tables that you see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then you've got academies that have been built for purpose to offer, you know, an international baccalaureate education or a really, you know, high credibility education that has international recognition, and they serve a purpose for a particular market of, you know, parents. You've got brand new schools coming in that are doing vertical buildings, that are doing a different spiral, kind of rich curriculum that's quite, you know, progressive. That they're taking some risks and they're getting some clientele that are running towards that model. Then you've got your typical metropolitan, you know, pillar schools, the ones that are just keep busting at the seams with enrollments because they're the school of choice.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the ones that aren't busting at the seams, that are static or declining, and that are getting plundered by schools, the private school that's around the corner, or the state school 15 kilometres to get into those preferred settings.
Mm.
It's such a strange place, education, at the moment. We're going to continue to grow as we move towards the Olympics. Schools are going to keep getting bigger and bigger and busting at the seams.
Yeah.
And there is more of those than those that are declining.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to make a decision around your school across all of this, you actually need to look at the the values that underpin the school and whether they live and breathe, because I think you can get caught out in a bit of a superficial representation of a school website and something that might come up in an interview with a really well-spoken person who is able to persuade and convince you of something, that when you pluck at the thread, there's actually a little bit less of that story that could be corroborated than actually is there. And I think you need to be an inquirer and need to think about it that way. And the best work you can do is before you get to that enrollment interview, so you ask the right questions. And I know we'll talk about that soon, but it's such a competitive market. Private schools are maintaining really similar enrollments rather than growing, and there's a real boutique nature about that. It makes it really like, I want to be in that school, one of the 1,600. And I think that drives people to desire and want them as as a product. The thing for me, what I've learned between private as a student and state is really about the values. Just forget about distance traveled and that plan, arbitrary, like that's important. Unpack it, it'll inform your decision and where the kids go and, you know, the pathways. Yeah, get it, completely understand it. But the qualitative and quantitative stuff that's not present there, you don't get until you actually interrogate and you really dig into it. That's not going to be there within it. It sits outside the pages. And
I think what you're revealing here for a lot of parents who might not know the school environment as well is that, you know, schools do operate as businesses. Like they have business managers, they have marketing departments, and, you know, there's all these marketing sort of ploys. So I think what you're really revealing for a lot of parents is that there is stories that are out there, either, you know, from your local newspaper or, you know, a school's website or billboards and all that sort of thing, but you really have to sift through it to find the right match. So you alluded there to some of the data points. So, you know, primary schools are putting out NAPLAN data. There's the ICARA stuff, there's ATAR, there's the university entrance, all that sort of thing. So help us understand, what does that data actually mean? How helpful is it? And you've sort of alluded to already that it's quite a particular presentation of a school's educational value. Yeah. But if we could dig into that a little bit, what are these numbers, these figures? How do we understand what's good, what's not good?
It's a tough question, because some figures are going to attract a certain parent who, you know, holds a belief that the percentage of students that move on to university pathways is an indicator of the academic resourcing in the school and the way that they prepare kids for successful learning. And I'm talking about paradigms here around university equaling success.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so people will read into that and look at that my school or whatever league table they look at and go, yep, I'm going to arrive at this conclusion. But they're already going in with preconceived ideals around what a good year 13 and beyond is. And they're using basically it's what's there and also what their own experience was. And I think we need to challenge those assumptions a little bit. ATAR is not a number that you're branded with for the rest of your life. It's used purely for tertiary purposes. There's a market that sits around it for declaring this from the high mountains and you know, showing, you know, where people put it on websites, infographics. They make a real, you know, and I get it. Like, your teachers are very proud of the data. They're proud of their students and they want their community to celebrate. I completely understand the affirmation, but I think ATAR needs to be taken as a school that's used for a tertiary pathway. It's got to be a bit of a, I don't know if it's different strokes or however you want to kind of explain it. I think attendance data is more so than ever a bit rubbery because of COVID. So I don't know what sort of sense you can get of a school around the engagement and retention of kids given what's happened since 2019.
Yeah.
But certainly I would encourage you to look at the school disciplinary absences as a point of reference. You know, what I'm talking about here is suspensions, short, middle and long term. Again, you've got to try and go on objectively, but what you're trying to understand is this just an atypical year where there was a spike and there was four kids in a cohort that did 75 behaviours that were horrible and went through a whole litany of suspensions, or is this actually a historical problem that's emerged? this has all public facing. This is what's quite remarkable. They say a little bit about a school, SDA stuff, disciplinary absences, but not everything.
Yeah.
NAPLAN, yeah, absolutely.
Can you break open what does NAPLAN test? What does it measure? What does that data mean? Because, you know, for a new or expecting dad, you know, maybe you're looking at buying a bigger house, if you had a second kid, you know, whatever it might be, like, you know, if you're buying a new house, you'd be looking at what primary schools are in the area.
Yeah.
Or if, even just anyone that's had a baby recently, they might be starting to think, okay, like a few years' time, like we got daycare, we got kindy, we got primary, what does that progression look like? So NAPLAN sort of figures in at that early stage as well for parents.
Yeah.
What does that mean? What is it trying to measure, I guess?
Yeah, so NAPLAN's completed year 3, 5, 7, and 9.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an Australian standardized test. So it tests writing, reading, comprehension, spelling and punctuation, and numeracy, right? So they're considered, maybe it's like the old 4 R's or whatever they had in the old system. But that's our way of, in 2-year milestones from, you know, year 3 onwards, touching bases with the country in terms of, you know, determining the standard that's there in each of those 4 disciplines. And,
yeah.
And then you start thinking of, well, what are the areas that aren't doing so well? Typically it's writing,
yeah,
in Australia, particularly Queensland.
Yeah.
And so behind that will sit a whole range of resourcing and work that schools will do. So it provides them with an interface or information on how well they're traveling. It's certainly something that people pride themselves in because, once again, dare I refer back to it, but it's declared in league tables, it's public facing, and the best are celebrated and affirmed, and those who sit outside of that, sit outside of that.
Mm.
So it tells you point in time how kids are tracking. And because of its presence, there's some great things that happen around schools reflecting and looking at resourcing different areas to build deficits or improve areas. But I think you've got to be really careful just around, again, you know, what it represents. Some of the things that we talk to, or I like to think of, is, you know, what's the distance traveled from the last test? What sort of gains are actually prevalent? Let's not look at the mean in the cohort or the school or the area.
Yeah.
It's about how far that they've traveled in the ones that they did quite well at and the ones that they didn't do so well at, and then understanding, okay, so what sits behind that? There's been 2 years that have lapsed. What's the work that happened in that school that has now been impactful and actually shown?
Because that seems to be more indicative of how well a school can actually support your child than the actual score is how much they have improved, hey?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, you said before about parents who are picking to buy homes and probably paying overs in catchments that are, the NAPLAN's extremely good, right?
Yeah.
And the thing about this is, ICSEA or socio-educational advantage is one of the reasons or predictors around why schools do so well.
Yes.
Right? So the idea that parents come from two incomes, you know, quite reasonable professional level, and they've had this educational experience up to bachelor or master's, and then they bring that into rearing a child, and they travel to these areas, they congregate together. And because of that proximity of that kind of financial stability and the education and I guess you could say it's like a microcosm, but it's like a bubble.
Yeah.
The advantage for those children to be in those classrooms, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why we'll see the school up the road in those areas being so well resourced is because of, you know, the outstanding results that they will produce.
Yeah.
And it's not to say that the ones that aren't producing aren't trying to resource and attend to the areas. It's just there's definitely a demarcation. There's some great stories of those schools 50 miles down the corridor that have done amazing things. We don't hear about them, but their distance travel based on their own educational more disadvantage than advantage is quite remarkable, but we're not talking about them. It's often just the ones who are in that top tier. It is a predictor. It's not the only variable, but it's certainly a predictor, those educational advantages. And I can understand why parents might actually look to move to a context knowing that information.
Yeah.
But again, I just go back to the 8 to 11 year old child.
Yeah.
what do they need?
Yeah.
You know, and really make having a fulsome picture. It's education, it's not schooling, and I think that's really, really important to understand the discernment between the two.
Yeah.
Right? My sister left school in year 11. She's highly successful in what she's done. She never finished. My brother left and went to a state school, didn't get an OP, did a course at college. It's graphic design. He's extremely successful, you know. The education element never stops. The schooling element has a bookend.
Yeah.
And I think you need to be really mindful of that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then outside of that NAPLAN, ATAR, you know, scores, data, figures that gets, you know, sort of published ad nauseum in the newspapers and whatnot, what are some other things that parents can look to when they're trying to evaluate the fit of the school?
I think the website's a good start. What I would say to you around websites is, you know, you mentioned before around the PR and marketing that happens. Yes. Schools are a market, and they have to market themselves a certain way to attract demographic. So you're right, there are business managers, there are marketing, you know, AO5 roles that purely are working on websites that construct a narrative around the school. Now, how accurate that narrative is probably the really important thing. Now, I'm a historian and I only corroborate information, right? That gives me a sense of confidence. You will find some amazing websites that will speak to, that will make you feel a certain way. And it's like advertising. They've deliberately positioned you to feel a certain way as you go and navigate, you know, that website. And I think that's great. That really sells education. I think there's a real positive to that. The challenge for you as a parent, though, is for you to actually interrogate and pluck at that a little bit. So the My School information is good. I think it's only up to 2021, so it's still got a year out of date, but that will tell you all of the things we've just, you know, aforementioned around, you know, the NAPLAN, the attendance, the retention, the year 12, all that stuff is there.
So that's the My School website?
That's My School. So that's again, arbitrary goalposts put in. I don't agree with all of them. They just need to be contextualized and then think about it.
Yeah.
They can inform your consideration. They shouldn't make the decision. But when you marry those two up, that will give you something. You'll start to realize quickly, you know, where there is some non-alignment between the messaging. And I went back to values before. Everyone will have, like, I don't know, they might have a Latin or a motto or a something, a statement of branding that captures them. There is a palpable difference between the schools that just have them there cosmetically and the ones that actually live and breathe it. And I've worked in both contexts knowing what that's like. So I think websites will show you a story. Within the websites, there's lots of things. They'll talk about their curriculum and specialist programs, what they do excellent at. Everything will be, we're excellent at this or we're really good at this. They're not going to say, we're actually going to get a little bit better in this. There's not a website in the world that's around a school that will showcase something that's a needs improvement, you know? And I completely understand that, you know, but it's absolutely positioning you for this particular picture of them. So grab that other data, interrogate it, think about them together. I think a really big indicator of a school is their alum. So like the old boys with Marist, alumni, how engaged are the alum? What do the alum say about the school? And if you're in an area, go down the road, like, and ask people who have shops or workplaces in that area about the kids. Alums show you their engagement and the way they conduct themselves post-school and the way they think about school is a good indicator of the connection they have, the sense of belonging they have when they were there, and the fact that they still retain it 4 or 5 years post-school and that they're still meaningfully engaged in some way. Talking to local people, all of that information is important. You'll get a sense of an enrollment interview about a school. And I think that's a really important process because it's formal. You're meeting with a child and a guidance officer, or you're meeting with a specialist enrollment officer. Listen to the way they are talking about the school. Listen to and ask them some probing. Don't be scared to ask some probing questions.
What sort of questions?
Okay, all right. So let's just say there's growth in a school. lots of growth. I would be really asking them, you know, if a school's busting at the seams, what are they actually doing around infrastructure with the growth that's coming?
Yeah.
What buildings are coming up, or what are you doing with the current? Like, ask that question. It might gobsmack them and they'll say, I might get back to you because they're not prepared for that. Because what they typically get is that kind of really affirmatory positive, oh, really excited. Jimmy's anxious to come here, wants to come. Let's sign, ICT agreement. Bring your own device. Great. You know, I'll speak to the guidance officer. Really excited. Sign the document. I'm going to start.
Yeah.
It's not very common that you throw some curly questions.
Yeah.
What partnerships exist? You know, who are you linked up with? QUT, UQ, Griffith, TAFE, work environment. Like, so let's talk about a big Deloitte's provider, or let's talk about someone in manufacturing. Like, who are your relationships with? Aviation, whatever. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are the kids doing meaningfully with them? Yeah. Okay, so what are the pathways? Like, what kids have actually gone on and done something that you've helped support through that relationship? I don't care if it's three kids that did aviation in the end. That's amazing because it's such a boutique area. And that wouldn't have happened in that context if they weren't there.
Mm.
That's happened because of that partnership.
Because
if they went to the school 20 Ks down the road, aviation isn't even on the menu, right?
Yeah.
So partnerships are really, really important.
And that partnerships and pathways question is a good one, even for daycares and primary schools, because I know, like, we've gone to daycare tours and they've talked about how they partner with the local primary schools. Kids from the primary come in and do some reading. And I think that's a good question, even from daycare, primary, secondary, as you're talking about. Yeah.
Ask them what are the values, whatever their iteration is of that, if it's a mission statement or not.
Yeah.
How are they lived in this school? How do you know?
Yeah.
Like, well, they're in the curriculum documentation. We refer to them on your level assembly. Awesome. So how else, you know, like, really understand that, because that can be powerful or it can be missing the mark.
Mm.
What's your point of difference as a school compared with the school down the road?
Mm.
Whether it's independent, Catholic, the academy, whatever it is, whatever institution, whatever kind of sector, what's your point of difference? Like, what do you do differently? And I think you need to kind of tackle that.
Mm.
Like, why do you do it differently? Will your child positively respond to that? You need to think about that as well.
Yeah.
Or find that maligning and actually something they won't gravitate towards.
Yeah. Yeah.
With private and state, you can't make this a black and white. Like, private aren't wholly elitist.
Yeah.
It's rubbish. They're not.
Yeah.
And state schools don't concede on quality.
Yeah.
Right? So let's make that really, really clear, because that's absolute falsity.
Yeah.
And that there are state schools that do better things than private schools, and private schools that do better things than state schools.
Yeah.
And there's more so than ever, state schools are performing and they're featuring in those league tables because of the great things and the resourcing and what they're doing, and they're competing in the market, right?
Mm-hmm.
Private schools are doing amazing too. You know, and that's, I think you need to consider that.
Just hearing you talk about different schools and performance and culture and all that sort of thing, like, you sometimes hear parents talk about, the type of school doesn't matter, like, it all depends on the kid's effort. Mm-hmm. Where do you sit on with that? Like, is that, would you agree with that as an educator, and hearing what you just said about different schools and what makes a school a great school? Does the school matter? Or really does it come down to the individual learner?
Good question. Schools absolutely matter because of the fit for your child. So if your child has a penchant for the arts and is exceptional at music, but their particular skill set is not being developed in their school because, unfortunately, the resourcing and funding for the arts has been on the decline, it's been invested elsewhere in STEM or say something, then your child will languish because they actually aren't having that developed, right? And so is that about effort and application, or is that around them actually having those blocks placed in front of them that allow them to have that progression?
Yeah.
So I'd kind of come back to a little bit there. I think the effort, you could put a very gifted and talented student in the school 50 kilometres down the corridor that's not as well resourced, that's got really static or declining enrollment numbers, are they still going to achieve a personal best? You'd want to hope so.
Yeah.
I can't confirm whether that is 100% the case and whether I'm a, you know, I'm a glass half full rather than empty, but yeah. You would think that, you know, the old OP1s, the 899.95s, they're still coming from those schools because of the capability of the student, right? The school will absolutely help move, perhaps not the very top end, but certainly a critical mass of students because of the resourcing, because of the quality, because of the way they're built. And, you know, I said before around socioeconomical advantage, that's zone of proximity, right? Like that's, they're those kids who are performing and lifting and then students going with that, right? We commonly see kids in groups. Their distance traveled, if academics is a real, you know, passion of theirs, they'll do it in a group and we will see that lift over the, by the end of their schooling. And it comes from that group mentality, right? That tribalism. The conversations that mum and dad are having at the table around education, that's coming home, that's filtering back, really, really important, because it's showing that connection of the bipartisan mum and dad at school and that we're all together. It's a community, and I think that's part of it.
You said just a little bit ago about that bipartisan relationship between school and parents. And this is a tension that comes up a lot, particularly by the time you get to secondary. But, like, what is actually the responsibility of the school? What's the responsibility of the parent? What is reasonably, you know, fair to expect of a school in terms of that relationship with the child and with the student?
The responsibility hasn't really changed that significantly in terms of parents sort of dropping their kids off at the gate and being, you know, interested in what's happening in schools. I think around just under a decade ago, there was a real push, particularly in state education, around parents as being stakeholders, is kind of the language they were using, and to really ingratiate them more into the fabric of the school. And it's PNC, it's school council, it's FATES, that's kind of the stuff, but it's actually parent-teacher interviews and different parent evenings, and really, really offering them that kind of transparency that probably wasn't there 20 years ago. And parents have today, and rightfully so, an interest in knowing what's happening in the classroom with their child. I totally get it. So I think the transparency part is the part that's different. I think for teachers that can be challenging though. Parents want agency as parents and they want to have this relationship with the school because it makes them feel a sense of confidence around their child and their security, that the learning is of a certain quality or standard. I get it. But I think it's about getting that balance that's really important because we're more and more open in our conversations around education with parents than I think we've ever been. And I just think we need to just consider where the continuum has gone or the pendulum has swung a little bit there, just to make sure that we are getting right and that we're not positioning our teachers to start thinking or devaluing the work that they're doing. And I think that's an important part. If the conversations that are happening at home at the table are really positive about school, that will translate to how they go back. If they're quite critical around an element of their education that Jimmy shares with mum and dad, and then their interpretation and their lens is this, and then they start unpacking it, and a leadership team or a teacher is, you know, completely unpacked in a negative way, that will feed into their views, their attitudes and their perceptions of school when they go back. So you've got to really get that right, and that's that relationship that can be amazing. Let me give you an analogy here. I drive a Subaru Forester and I have for 3 years, right? I would be ill-fated to walk into, you know, a manufacturing warehouse, to go to the service floor and to start making judgments, you know. I mean, I know what I like about the car when I drive it. For 3 years, I've liked the height because I'm 6'2". I've liked, you know, the windows that are tinted. I've liked, you know, the different cameras that are good for security.
Yeah.
But I'm not sitting with an engineer going through blueprints, understanding the strategic intent of the vehicle, right? Like I'm not going under the car with an auto, like a mechanic, and looking at the underneath and looking at why all the parts fit together and getting inside and understanding that.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm certainly, you know, not there to talk with, you know, old senior Bill, who has owned Subaru for the last 20 years and three generations. And there's a reason why Subarus are built a certain way, because that cultural tapestry began decades ago.
Yeah.
Right. Before that all happened. I'm ill-equipped to walk into that factory floor and start making those things, even though I've driven in the car for 3 years and I experience it in the day. I experience it superficially. And I think, I guess the point I'm trying to make is there is strategic intent that sits in education that's a little bit beyond the comprehension of parents. And parents are very smart, and I'm not saying it's cognitively not, but they're capable of understanding. But they've got 40 hours of work and more they spend building their own expertise in areas that sit aside from it. So they're basing a lot of their assumptions or impressions on the experience of their child that they share back, the communication they see on emails, and whatever other exposure they have to the school. I just think we need to be really mindful that education isn't that simple, that teaching sequences, assessment, moderation, the inner nuances of the school and those machinations is not something that a parent will necessarily understand. Okay. And I think that's been probably one of the rubs, if there was any rub, is just really trying to make sure that we are working, you know, together in a really fruitful way, because I think when those layers are interrogated, but without that understanding, that critical understanding, that can be really hurtful and impactful for leaders and for teachers. The great things that schools can do can't be done without parents, because of the parents are there supporting their children to attend the school. They're talking about that school and affirming the school at, to their friends and their families. And they're helping to create the memories that a child has with school that are really, really important. But the sense of belonging their kid will get with school is dependent on the school and everything I've just talked about, but also around the parents' relationship with the school. If there's a friction or demarcation, then it will not work.
Yeah.
And of course, at times when your child's vulnerable and not doing so well, you want to ramp that up. You want to make sure, because you're feeling a little bit ill-equipped because you're not in the school for that 30 hours that they're there.
Yeah.
You're at work or you're elsewhere hearing that it's not going so well.
Yeah.
And part of your compassion and empathic self is you want to do something and fix that. But the way that you go about it needs to be, you know, done in a really careful, thoughtful manner. But absolutely reach out to the school, but just be really mindful of the when and the how. Because it only works when everyone's working together collaboratively.
Yeah. Mate, you've given us some absolute gold in this chat around data, around schools, around the different types of schools. That importance of the conversation around the dinner table with kids about how school is going and about the importance of education. Let's rewind back to pick either of your boys, but to you know, rewind back to the delivery room.
Yeah.
What would be the advice you'd give yourself to your past self standing in that delivery room?
Yes.
What would you say to past Ross?
Yeah.
About fathering and advice. Yeah.
The things that I would say that really were important for Kate and I is the work that you do when she comes out of the hospital. Okay. So this is interesting. So to contextualize it, for those of you who, you know, maybe having your first kid, that 4 or 7, the time that they're there at the hospital, they're on endone, they're bedridden, there's a bit of walking around, they feel physically and psychologically ravaged.
Yeah.
It's a major, major surgical procedure they undergo. They are released because they want the mother to build that bond with the child. And when they're, you know, they need the more that's within the home environment and you can build that, the better. But you don't feel that you're ready when they are released, but you're released and you go together and you get home. And I would, one of the most important things that I was told to do was the role that I would have as on point to manage the people, the humans coming into the house.
Yes.
This is a really critical bit, right? Because they're still taking endone and they're still really emotionally going on a roller coaster. But they're not really, Kate wasn't able to kind of think the way she wanted to think.
Yeah.
And God bless human beings. They, when they hear of a new baby, Everyone is all about that. Your friends, yeah. your family, everybody wants to be a part of that.
Yeah.
And for me, what I would do is, you know, I would ward off the people that wanted to come over, and I would be, you know, a, sort of saying, "What's up? Like, what do you want to do? Come in the house? Okay, when you come in, what I need from you is to wash up or to do the folding."
Yeah, yeah.
Or I'd be messaging saying, "Can you bring some food over?"
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's no way I'm letting you lob up to the house while Kate, you know, who knows where we are, whether, you know, Hugo or George was sleeping at that time.
Yeah.
Probably more Hugo my first time. This was challenging. Because that was the obsession, right? Yeah, it's your first. Yeah. I would be tasking them with something that they wanted them to bring before they could even hold the baby.
Yeah.
You're not touching the baby for your very selfish,
self-indulgent.
Absolutely. Like, absolutely. And I love that you've come here. Please don't think I'm a jerk. Like, I love that you're here.
Yeah.
I need you to do one of these things. And I was militant with it.
Yeah.
And because I'm, I guess, a bit of a teacher, I was like, boom, 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 and really direct. And, you know, what it meant was that people were coming over and Kate was able to eat, or we had one less task and we had some respite of something that we didn't have to attend to, because you're still trying to tick over, you're all on your own and you're feeling really vulnerable. And it's great having people around you, but it was exhausting. And let's be honest, they're there to ask the same superficial questions about how things are going, how you're feeling.
Yeah.
And then lots of chat about the baby, right? And they're just sitting there trying to find normality or some similitude of being okay. And it's actually the last thing on their mind, but because we're compassionate people, we want to share that with people.
Yeah.
So I found that hard. I think the best thing that you can do is have a pre-approach. I know you did, Adam, with yours, and I think maybe we talked about it. Maybe
I think we did.
And, you know, I think yours was on point. Yours was, you know, get back in your box when time is right. We will have some exposure, but I've got to get around my girl and get around my new child and make this work in a unit, you know, and there's a whole heap in there. So I'm not going to engage your self-indulgence at the moment. Your time will come. And you need to be a little bit, as I said, really direct with the people you love about that. They will understand because you're coming from a good place and you'll be picking up the pieces when they leave.
Okay. That's it.
And you'll be trying to pick yourself up too, because I'm telling you right now, it's you feel really vulnerable and you have your pitfalls as well, navigating that as a dad. And you know, the only other thing is, it's being okay to share with your partner if things aren't going well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm pretty stoic kind of a guy, and I don't typically share my emotions
till we get you on the podcast.
But I guess what I had to do more so was, because my nonverbals were saying that I wasn't happy, Kate would just be looking and going, "What's the problem?" And because in me there's that, well, we don't talk about, you know, how things are going, and that I'm actually feeling, I'm panicking, and he's not sleeping, he's not feeding, I can't help this, I can't fix it, I'm a fixer, I can't fix it, I'm bereft in this situation. You know, I feel like, that was really important. And I think when you do that and your partner sees that and it's done in an authentic way, and that you know, that's, it's really, really powerful and it builds that trust in the two of you.
Oh, thank you for joining us on the podcast, Ross. It, such a cool pleasure for me, because as I said, we're family. Your youngest is what, days apart from my boys. So, just really cool to have you on the pod, and pick your brain. And I think we'll have to come back and do a part two at some point. Just
there's so much,
there's so much to open up. Thank you so much, man. I appreciate
pleasure,
it.
Mate. Cheers.
Awesome.
Awesome. And we also want to thank our listener for tuning in today. If you haven't already, go check out our website at www.dadsgroup.org. In this space, we've got some awesome resources for support for families, new and expecting families. There's a lot of mental health support there by some amazing organizations. On this website as well, you can also support Dad's Group through purchasing our merchandise, or a solid donation would be amazing and help us impact the lives and of new and expecting families all around Australia. But thank you guys so much for tuning in, and we'll catch you next week. Cheers, guys.